Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Technological innovation is one thing. The laws that govern it are another. In 2014, some pending legal cases could lead to profound changes in how technology is developed and used in the future. Ars Technical Senior Business Editor Sarus Farivar has been following those cases. He joins us now by phone from California. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
There are several cases that involve the NSA data collection and the Edward Snowden leaks. Two of them involve the legal precedent from 1970 that allows police to track numbers from a single phone. What's the connection between the NSA cases and the NSA data collection and the Snowden leaks?
Well, what's interesting is that, so Edward Snowden, of course, listeners may remember, revealed in his very first leak that was published by The Guardian by the journalist Glenn Greenwald, showed that the NSA has been routinely compelling telecoms, specifically Verizon, to hand over what's called metadata in terms of telephone calls made basically on an ongoing basis. So that means every number that's been called to and from all Verizon numbers in the U.S. And the date and time that those calls were made. The government has argued that, citing a legal precedent from the 1970s, that it's allowed to do that. That case, called Smith versus Maryland, refers to the data, the metadata, for one particular phone call, one particular set of phone calls from one person to the government rather than a whole bulk data handover, as is in this case.
And what's their argument about why it applies?
Well, their argument is that, there's something called the third-party doctrine, and that is an idea in the law that says that once you transact with a business, be that a bank, be that a phone company, the fact that you have made a call, that call, the information about that call is no longer private. You have handed it over to a third party. So if I call you and I'm using Verizon's network to do it, Verizon has to know that I called you in order to give me the service of using my phone. Therefore, that information is not private, and therefore the government can get it. This is what the government argues.
So a third case involving NSA surveillance is Juul versus NSA, and it was filed in 2008 by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. How have these more recent cases impacted the potential outcome of that one?
Well, yeah. So as you said, Juul v. NSA is a case that has been going on for some time now and well predates the Snowden leaks. This was a case that argued based on an AT&T technician named Mark Klein, who showed that there was sort of a secret room at an AT&T facility in San Francisco that was sort of shunting data to the NSA. Now, that case has sort of moved very slowly, but I think the hope is that given that there has been much more disclosures and much more information about exactly what the NSA is doing, that case can continue to move forward.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Sarus Farivar. He is the Technical Senior Business Editor at Ars Technica and has been following the pending legal cases that could lead to profound changes in how technology is developed and used in the future. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Let's move on to Kim.com. You wrote about the criminal case against Kim.com, the founder of Mega Upload. Kim.com, that's a legal name, right?
Yes, Kim.com.
I just wanted to double check.
Yes, Kim.com was born Kim Schmitz in Germany, but some time ago he changed his legal name to Kim.com.
Okay, boring. All right, so this is a U.S. copyright infringement case, but .com is facing extradition from New Zealand, and it's a criminal case against him. What's that?
Well, so the charge is that through his website, Mega Upload, which he claims is nothing more than a CyberLocker type site, something analogous to Dropbox or Box.com or any number of other websites where people can easily share files. The U.S. government claims that through his site, he induced people to commit copyright infringement and, as a result, seized his assets and smashed his website back in 2012. Since then, the United States government has been desperately trying to extradite him from New Zealand, where he has legal residency. But as it turns out, the New Zealand government has been conducting illegal surveillance against Kim.com, and Kim.com now has legal filings against the New Zealand government. So this all may throw a big wrench into the American legal case.
Because can they extradite him when he has legal proceedings going against the government?
Well, the question of extradition has yet to be determined.
Okay.
He's claiming that he should be allowed to see much more evidence from the New Zealand government before a determination of extradition can be made. So that is a case that we're looking to hear be decided by the Supreme Court of New Zealand later this year. And then he has, as I said, a separate case where he's suing the New Zealand government for all of the surveillance that was done illegally, which was admitted by the government itself.
His lawyers claim, or I think his American lawyers claim, that there's no criminal case, just a civil one. How does that issue impact the broader tech landscape with what's happening here?
Well, I think, this is an argument that has been made by other similar people in other similar jurisdictions. What makes this case sort of interesting is that this is a really large case involving the United States government, which has shown that, despite the fact that Mr.com may reside in another country, despite the fact that its users may be abroad, the United States has shown that it can use its resources to shut down massive cases of what it believes to be copyright infringement. The case is somewhat reminiscent of the Pirate Bay, which is a big website originally based out of Sweden, where people trade BitTorrent files. And despite a massive legal case in Sweden, that site continues to operate independently.
So you think it's going to get resolved in 2014?
It's hard to tell. This case, I think, has been moving much more slowly than the United States authorities would like. Kim.com has certainly put up a staunch legal defense and has shown that New Zealand abused its authority when they conducted illegal surveillance against him and illegally searched his home. So I think he has, some serious grievances to be made. Whether or not, the extradition is finally resolved this year remains to be seen. But hopefully, now that we're getting closer to the end, or at least the beginning of the end, we can finally figure out what will become of Kim.com, who, by the way, despite the fact that he's having all of these things go against him, has managed to start other businesses as well. So Kim.com's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Did I read he was running for office or something like that?
Yeah, I believe he's planning on starting a new political party in New Zealand
that's right.
Later this year.
Well, anyone can. Silk Road. We've talked about that on the show before. The alleged mastermind behind the Silk Road website is the target of another case. Silk Road was where you could spend bitcoins for all sorts of alleged misdeeds, from human trafficking to drug deals and so forth. What's the status of that? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Silk Road, of course, people can think of it sort of like the Amazon.com of illegal everything, particularly illegal drugs. So you could go on there and use Bitcoin, as you said, which was required, and use Tor, which is an internet anonymizing tool, which was also required, to buy everything from marijuana to heroin and more. As you said, a gentleman by the name of Ross Ulbricht was arrested in California in October 2013. He's since been transferred to New York, where he's awaiting trial. There hasn't been much that's happened in the Silk Road case in the last couple of months. The government has put out a bunch of material showing that Mr. Ulbricht was indeed behind the Silk Road, and there was a long letter to the judge requesting that his bail be denied, which it was. The government has also published a photo that we published of a bunch of fake driver's licenses that the government says belong to Mr. Ulbricht, showing his ill intent.
So I saw that picture, and I get that that's not allowed. That's against the law. But how can he be held liable for how people use this website? For instance, take Craigslist. Are they being held liable for when people misuse that?
Well, I think the case here is different because unlike Craigslist, Craigslist does not take a cut of every deal made on Craigslist.
Okay.
I recently bought, you know, a jogging stroller used on Craigslist the other day for $20. Craigslist didn't take a cut of that deal. That was a private deal between me and the seller. Silk Road, however, while it did provide the means for people to conduct these illegal drug deals, Silk Road also took a cut of each deal. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Ulbricht, according to the government, is believed to have made millions of dollars as a result of this.
And moving slowly. LavaBit. You wrote about LavaBit. You wrote about it's perhaps not as well known as one involving the email service LavaBit. Familiarize us with what you've written about.
Right. So LavaBit is a company based out of Texas that provided a commercial private email service. It was a security-minded email company. It got a lot of attention in the wake of the Snowden disclosures because it seemed to be the case that Mr. Snowden was using LavaBit for his own personal email. And as a result, LavaBit was being asked by the government to hand over user data widely believed to be Mr. Snowden's email. However, in so doing, the government demanded LavaBit's private SSL key, which would basically allow the government to access not just Snowden's email, but all email of all of its users. We're talking about many thousands of people who have, you know, no reason to be suspected of anything by the government. They just happen to be sort of caught up in the collateral damage of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, the company's founder decided to shut the company down rather than give the government access. So the gentleman behind LavaBit, a guy by the name of Ladar Levison, is now fighting the government, and this is now being appealed at the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fourth Circuit. Saying that, you know, the government did not have the authority to ask for the data that it asked for.
Why did they need the SSL key just to access Snowden's emails?
Due to the way that LavaBit was set up, that was basically the only way that the government could legally force them to do that. His email was encrypted, so they couldn't really just single out his service. And this was sort of part of the way the LavaBit system was designed. So it made it much more difficult for the government to target Snowden specifically.
Okay, well, Cyrus Farivar, I want to thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Cyrus Farivar, he is the technical senior business editor for Ars Technica and has been following the pending legal cases that we were just talking about. If you want more information, we'll have a link to his story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to talk with the reporter for Huffington Post about the global underground market for stolen smartphones. So stay with us on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As more of us own smartphones, more smartphones are the targets of theft and at the heart of a growing international black market. Huffington Post tech reporter Jerry Smith has been covering the global underground market for stolen smartphones, and he joins us now by phone from New York. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us an idea of how big the black market is for smartphones?
Well, one security firm has estimated that the underground market for stolen phones is worth about $30 billion a year. It's a very lucrative underground trade, and it's, you know, ranges from the thefts that are happening on the streets of U.S. cities to buyers and sellers all around the world.
What does it represent in the number of phones being stolen here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, you know, the about 40% of all robberies now in major cities are either smartphones or tablets. So, you know, these devices, people are carrying them around, and they're getting stolen on, you know, subways and in cafes. And then there's this whole very sophisticated organized crime syndicates that are shipping these phones. You know, some of the phones are being resold in the U.S., but a lot of them are going overseas because you can actually sell a stolen phone for a lot more money in a lot of other countries. In Hong Kong and Brazil, for example, a stolen iPhone can go for as much as $2,000.
Why are they selling for so much in Hong Kong?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, one of the things is that, I mean, in Brazil, for example, where you can get, you know, a stolen phone, you know, iPhones are just going for, you know, $1,500. There's high taxes and import tariffs. And I believe that's the same case with in Hong Kong, where a lot of phones are, you know, actually ending up in Hong Kong and then being smuggled into mainland China. And the reason that they're being smuggled and not being distributed through legal channels is that there's, you know, high taxes and import tariffs on these devices.
How did your investigation into this lead you to Colombia?
Well, the last year, the Colombian government actually hosted a summit where they invited government officials and police officials from all around the world. There was a representative from the Federal Communications Commission in the U.S. who came, officials from Scotland Yard in Britain, and they all arrived in Colombia last fall to talk about how they're all having the same problem, which is that smartphone thefts are becoming increasingly frequent, and they're also becoming increasingly violent. I mean, I traveled to Bogota, and I focused part of my story on a young lawyer who was killed for his smartphone last year. And you know, I've also written stories about people in the U.S. who've been killed in smartphone robberies. So these, you know, these thefts, they're increasingly frequent, but there's also, you know, serious human costs here where people are not just losing their phone, but they're also losing their lives.
I'm trying to wrap my brain around killing somebody for a smartphone. I mean, why don't they just steal van loads of them like they do mattresses or drugs?
You're seeing that as well. I mean, there's also, you know, sophisticated, I mean, there's robberies of cell phone dealerships all around the country. This is also a huge problem. But, you know, the cell phone thefts that are happening just one at a time, oftentimes what happens is people won't give up the phone willingly, even if they've got a knife or gun in their face. These phones have become so valuable to people. They have so much information on there, all their email contacts, phone contacts,
right,
personal banking information, that these phones mean so much to them that even when, you know, a thief corners them in an alley or something with a gun or a knife in their face, some people are not willingly giving up the device. And when that's happening, that's actually where, you know, some of these more violent robberies are taking place.
But the value to the thief is not the information on the phone. It's the technology of the phone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's certainly there is the potential for identity theft. If a thief steals your smartphone and you have, you know, if they can access any of the personal information there, any of your email addresses or your personal banking, there is a potential for that.
Mm-hmm.
But most of what's happening is these phones are being sold and then resold and then resold again. I mean, one of the things that, you know, the U.S. wireless carriers, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint, they've tried to crack down on stolen phones being reused again in the U.S. In fact, they're just now implementing this database where if a thief steals a phone, you know, that phone can't be reactivated on one of their networks. So what police are telling me is that because this database is now in place, a lot of these thieves are shipping the phones overseas, not just because they can get more money for it, but also because the phones themselves won't work anymore in the United States.
You've reported that the same South American cartels that have trafficked in drugs are now buying and distributing stolen phones. Why have they gotten into the business? It's that lucrative?
You know, it's not as lucrative as cocaine trafficking.
Okay.
But, you know, one Colombian prosecutor told me that the reason they're seeing some of these narco traffickers who are now also trafficking stolen smartphones is because it's less risky. A lot of countries in Latin America are now really cracking down on our narco trafficking and spend a lot of their law enforcement resources on this. So people who are carrying stolen smartphones in their the linings of their jackets or in secret compartments of their suicases at the airport, that's not so much on the radar of a lot of these police departments in Latin America. So the reason they're getting into it is certainly a lucrative business, but it's also, it's a less risky business.
My guest is Jerry Smith, tech reporter for Huffington Post. He's been writing about the global underground market for stolen smartphones. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Can you take us step by step from the point of a theft to where the phone will end up for resale? Most of the thefts, I would imagine, are people just grabbing them out of idiots' purses like me who leave them open in the grocery store?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, these phones are getting stolen, like I said, everywhere.
Right.
I mean, in a lot of times they're getting snatched on the subways, where a thief will grab the phone right as the doors are about to close and run out. That's happened quite a bit in D.C. and New York and Chicago. And then from there, I mean, if the thief can sell it quickly, before the phone gets, the term is called bricking the phone, where basically it no longer works because the cell phone carrier has disabled it. If the thief can steal or sell that phone again, they can make some money off of that. And in fact, police have told me that a stolen phone can get resold, within an hour. There's a market in San Francisco, in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, where a lot of stolen phones are ending up, and police are actually tracking a lot of these phones via the GPS. Like, your iPhone has an app called Find My iPhone, and the police often use that, and they'll be able to trace these phones to these places where a lot of these phones are getting resold. But one of the stories I did was there was a storefront in suburban Detroit where, according to police, thieves were bringing dozens and dozens of stolen iPhones, iPads, and it was sort of a nondescript storefront in a suburban shopping center. And according to police, I mean, this is where a lot of these phones would get shipped. And then Sprint has actually filed a lawsuit against this company. The company is called Ace Wholesale, and Sprint is alleging that this company is actually shipping these phones overseas as far as Hong Kong. So I reached out to Ace Wholesale for a comment, and they didn't respond. But that's one of, according to law enforcement, I spoke to an agent with the Department of Homeland Security, and he said that there's storefronts that are similar to this around the country where thieves will steal a phone and they'll bring it to one of these storefronts, and these people will bundle up hundreds and hundreds of stolen phones and then traffic them overseas.
A big part of the process is finding someone with the technology to hack into the smartphones in order to use them on other devices. How does that work?
Right, yeah, because, I mean, that's one of the things that I found when I was speaking to police in Colombia, is there was this one guy who was very well known amongst these stolen phone traffickers because he had computer software that allows you to unlock a phone. And what that means is that the phone can then be used on any wireless network anywhere in the world. A lot of times when you and I buy a smartphone, we're locked into, AT&T's network or Verizon's network. But if you can unlock the phone, that allows that phone to be used on any wireless network. And so when these phones are getting shipped overseas, they have to be unlocked. So a phone that ends up in Hong Kong can be used on a Hong Kong wireless carrier, for example. So the people who do this are one, they're one member of this sophisticated traffickers, and they have a very unique skill set where they can essentially hack into these phones so they can be used on any cell phone network anywhere.
You spoke with an informant who's helping police. What can you tell us about him and what you learned from him? And is this police in Colombia or in the United States?
This was when I was down in Bogota, Colombia.
Okay.
And police actually said, you can talk to this guy. but he doesn't want you to use his name or his physical characteristics. And when I met with the informant, I asked him, you know, why that is, and he said that he was genuinely concerned for his safety because he is an undercover informant. And if any of the stolen phone traffickers down there found out that he was working with police, that, you know, his life might be at stake. But no, I met with him, and you know, he explained to me how there are phones that come from the United States that are stolen that end up in Colombia, and from there they go to this little market in downtown Bogota, where a lot of stolen phones from around South America and all around the world are actually being resold in this sort of this little shopping center. And the phones that aren't resold there end up getting smuggled into Peru and Ecuador and all across South America. But yeah, I mean, I asked him, you know, how do you know where these phones are coming from? How do you know they're from the United States? And he told me that a lot of times you'll turn on the phone and it'll say, you know, T-Mobile or AT&T logo will show up on the device. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the Colombian police also told me that they've intercepted shipments of phones that they believe are stolen in Colombia, and they believe that the phones originated from Miami, Florida.
How did they figure that out?
Well, they, you know, they've been investigating.
Serial numbers or?
Yeah, I mean, they've investigated this. I mean, their two methods are, one, they have these police informants who give mm-hmm. them information, and also they've been wiretapping the conversations of these phone traffickers. And by listening to the wiretap conversations, they heard that, you know, that there was this shipment of phones that they believe are stolen that were coming from Miami, and they were arriving in Bogota Airport. And so then when they picked up the phones from Bogota Airport, they pulled them over and found the phones. So, you know, what I wanted to do is I tried to find out whether the phones were in any kind of U.S. Database for stolen smartphones, because a lot of times if a phone gets reported to police as being stolen, it'll end up in a database. I didn't find any of these phones. The Colombian police gave me their serial numbers. I didn't find any of them to be in the database. But oftentimes these phones, either they're not reported stolen in the first place, or these thieves can actually change the serial numbers on these phones so they don't appear to be stolen in any kind of database.
Which kind of eliminates the usefulness of the serial number. Colombians are being warned not to carry the phones in the streets, and the government created have created PSA commercials to encourage people not to buy stolen phones. Can you talk about those ads and what people in Colombia understand about what they're buying?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the things that surprised me about when I was down there, is that smartphone theft is just a huge problem down there, much bigger, in fact, and more violent than it is in the United States. And it's gotten so bad that the mayor of Bogota, the capital of Colombia, recently warned residents not to carry their cell phones around in public, which a lot of people thought was ridiculous. But it speaks to how serious this problem has become down there. And as you mentioned, the Colombian government went so far as putting out these television commercials that were sort of public service announcements. And if you look at the commercials, they're pretty gruesome. I mean, there's one commercial where there's people, you know, they're on their smartphones and they're laughing and they're buying flowers and reading books, and all of a sudden blood starts coming out of the smartphone. And there's a message in Spanish that essentially translates to, if you buy a stolen phone, you're carrying around a dead person. And essentially what they're trying to say is that a lot of the phones that people are buying in Colombia secondhand at some of these you know, used phone markets are coming from robberies where some of the victims have been killed.
And then conversely, is it a warning to them that they could end up the same way?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly. I mean, it's not just the buying, you know, that you may be buying a phone that was stolen from somebody who was killed, but if you're walking around Bogota, you know, holding your phone, you also might be a target of a robbery that could put your life in danger.
And that's such a common way that we use our phones, our cell phones, our smartphones. We always are hanging on to them with our hands. They're not usually put away very often.
Right. I mean, I spoke to several people in Colombia who say that when they want to use their phone, they don't bring it out in public. I mean, if they want to use the map function to figure out where they're going, they'll duck into, a store and then check their phone, because the risk of getting your phone stolen, even if you just have it out in your hands for a couple minutes, is so high that people now, they really will just, they'll check their phone only if they're, like, making sure that they're not in an open-air area where it might get stolen from them.
You said that the cartels are getting into this business because it's less risk than the narco drug trade. What is law enforcement in Colombia doing to crack down on it?
Yeah, I mean, the two main things they're doing is they're actually fighting this problem the same way that they fought the drug trafficking problem. They're relying on wiretaps.
Okay.
Where they're trying to infiltrate these cartels by wiretaps and by cultivating informants. Another thing that's starting to happen is that the governments in different countries and the wireless carriers in different countries are now working together, where if a phone gets stolen in one country, it can't be reactivated in another country, because what's happening a lot of times is these phones will get stolen in one country in Latin America, and then they'll get smuggled into another country. And so if the wireless carriers are saying, you know, if we can prevent these phones from being reactivated anywhere, then they'll essentially become useless and they won't have any value to thieves. And then, you know, perhaps this problem will be lessened. I mean, one of the things that's been happening in the United States is the Attorney General in New York, Eric Schneiderman, and the District Attorney in San Francisco, George Gascon, have been calling on Apple and Samsung and all the smartphone makers to create what's called a kill switch. And what that would mean is that as soon as a phone is stolen, it becomes completely worthless, that it can't be used for anything. Because right now, I mean, if you steal a phone, maybe the wireless carrier deactivates it, but you can still use that phone for if you have a Wi-Fi connection. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, these phones are like little computers. So it's, they still have value. And so what these law enforcement officials in the U.S. are saying is that these manufacturers need to create some sort of kill switch technology so that the phone, once it's stolen, it can't be used in any country anywhere.
And are they amenable to that?
Well, so far, it's, Apple is, this past summer introduced a new security feature, mm-hmm, called Activation Lock, that they said is going to go a long way towards, making these phones less desirable to thieves. It's still sort of in the early stages. It's hard to tell whether this is actually working. For example, in this past year, New York City has said that the number of robberies of Apple products increased yet again. Mm. Samsung has also looked at introducing a security feature for their smartphones, which are also enormously popular. And they've actually been blocked, according to the DA in San Francisco, this feature has been blocked by some of the wireless carriers, and the reason is that they have they make a lot of money off of insurance of phones, where people buy insurance, and the DA in San Francisco is saying that the wireless carriers are preventing this security feature because it may cut back on some of the profits they might make from selling you cell phone insurance.
All right, then. Okay, that's encouraging. Jerry Smith, thanks a lot for talking with us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jerry Smith, he's tech reporter for Huffington Post. He's been covering the global underground market for stolen smartphones. Coming up, Russell Holley from Geek.com. Talk to us about that Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The International Consumer Electronics Show is underway in Las Vegas. The event showcases the latest and coolest gadgets and technology from around the world. And joining us now to tell us what's been revealed so far and what to expect this week is tech blogger for Geek.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
So it is this usual strange reveal post Christmas season what the best and brightest ideas are in technology. AT&T made an announcement yesterday that is causing quite a stir. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. So AT&T, before CES every year, hosts an annual developer conference where they roll out new ideas for developers to take advantage of and use, you know, specifically with AT&T's networks. And one of the things that they announced last year was, you know, this kind of broader initiative for developers to be able to use data sets, you know, to help customers. And that kind of changed this year into what is going to be called sponsored data. And this is it's an interesting idea, but it has the potential to be kind of terrible. The concept here is that a developer or, you know, a company essentially will be able to, you know, offer AT&T customers, you know, a small chunk of data that is basically free on AT&T in exchange for, you know, some advertising time or, you know, maybe just as a promotional offer. You know, for an example, someone could, you know, could say, you know, there's a florist and you order something from this florist and you get 50 megabytes of data tacked onto your regular, you know, monthly statement for this month that you can use. Or someone would be able to say, you know, there's a television series that's coming out and the first episode will be free for you to watch across AT&T's LTE network. It won't count against your data if you watch this on LTE or you know, instead of watching it on Wi-Fi.
Uh-huh.
And so this is something that they announced yesterday that developers are going to have access to, where they will be able to, you know, offer this as a service to AT&T customers starting relatively soon. They haven't given a firm date yet.
So it sounds great. It's like, oh, I'm getting something for free, but nothing's free because it's changing what sort of access you have to other content.
Well, it's you know, it's creating a potentially dangerous market. I mean, it's you know, creating a situation where, you know, first of all, nothing is changing about how much data you actually have. You know, so if you don't exceed the amount of data that you use every month on a regular basis, then, you know, you're not actually getting anything out of this free thing anyway. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, watching a video or something, it really depends on your usage as far as whether or not this is even beneficial to you. But beyond that, it creates a situation where, you know, two companies who are offering the exact same thing have the potential to, you know, get more eyeballs onto one specific thing by saying, you know, I have, you know, I can make this so that it's free if you watch it on AT&T, whereas this other guy can't.
And eventually they'd be bidding for, I mean, there'd be a market for that then.
Right. They would essentially be, you know, be selling you back megabytes that you kind of technically should already have. In order to watch this content, and it's a weird, you know, kind of jab at, you know, kind of the fundamentals of net neutrality. Like, this is something that couldn't happen on a regular wired network. You know, like Comcast or Verizon couldn't do this because there are net neutrality laws in place to stop this from happening.
Okay.
But the net neutrality laws are actually they don't apply to mobile in this situation. So this is something that AT&T is allowed to kind of test the waters with.
And has anybody suggested that the law should be applied to them?
There are tons of people who have suggested that the law should apply to mobile. This was something that was actually waved away from mobile last year. And this may be, you know, this may be what happens, you know, that causes a larger discussion about whether or not that should be fixed.
So I guess I don't have to ask why a company like AT&T would want to develop this kind of program. It's to make money, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially if you are the kind of person who doesn't use their maximum data every single month, AT&T is effectively able to, you know, to empower developers in such a way that they end up charging twice for the same amount of data. You know, if you don't go over your normal monthly data, but someone gives you a free episode of television and you go to watch it, but you were never, ever going to, you know, bypass that data mm-hmm. limit anyway. AT&T is effectively charged twice for that episode of television because
they're charging you,
regardless of whether or not,
right.
Yeah, they're charging both companies. They're charging mm-hmm. charging both sides. So it's really not great for anyone involved except for AT&T. And it was really hard when watching the presentation yesterday to see that there was nothing really beneficial to the user aside from kind of a new way to see potentially free things. but they really aren't free when you think about it.
So what was the reaction to this?
The people in the crowd were generally kind of apathetic about it. There wasn't, you know, like a roar of applause or anything, but
okay.
it was kind of a new thing that I'm sure that once there are actual rules in place, because this was, you know, this was demonstrated on stage, but there are still no, rules or sign up or anything for it. So once that happens, I think that, you know, developers will have a better idea of what's going on, and whether this will sink or swim, I guess, will depend on that.
There's the Pebble Steel Smart Watch. Now, Pebble is the name of a company.
Pebble is the name of a company and the name of a product.
Okay. So
the Pebble smartwatch is one of my favorites that are out there right now. It's definitely the best for iOS and for Android, as just kind of a good watch that delivers good information to your wrist. But it's really kind of plasticky and not very nice looking. You wouldn't wear this when you were wearing a suit or, you know, going to a nice function of any kind.
Okay.
And that has been one of the downsides to the Pebble, is that, you know, it's really a very sporty, you know, very kind of cheap looking watch. And so they kind of went back to the drawing board, and for CES this year, they announced the Pebble Steel, which is the Pebble design in a stainless steel casing. So it looks much, much nicer. It has a very professional look to it, and definitely looks like something that, anybody would be comfortable wearing, as opposed to just people who are okay with sporty looking bands.
Okay, besides the good old "gee, what time is it?" function of a watch, what does it do that's so great?
Well, so it's tethered to your phone constantly, so it gives you access to any information that would come from your phone. It's one of those things similar in effect to Google Glass, where it stops the kind of constant reach into your pocket or your purse to check your phone if you have a notification.
Okay.
And they just opened the Pebble App Store, which, and you know, really enabled a bunch of developers to come up with some very cool things for, you know, that you would be able to do from your watch, through to other things. And some of them are a little crazy, like being able to control the locks on your front door or the lights in your house from your wrist. But a lot of them end up being just kind of very simple time saver things, and even some fitness accessories.
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
I was just trying earlier this week, because I've been using it for a while now. I was actually just trying it as a sleep monitor, where it actually tracks, you know, how you move in your sleep and determines, how well you're sleeping. And it's one of those things where, you know, you wear the watch to bed, and when you wake up in the morning, your phone has the information for you to look at.
Right. I mean, it's just combining a lot of different things in one item, but it has to be paired with your smartphone, which makes me wonder, when is Apple going to buy out Pebble?
Well, it was definitely, you know, this was one of the things that made Pebble so popular, was this was the first smartwatch when they came out. This was a Kickstarter project. It was actually the biggest Kickstarter project that has ever happened. They came out and said, you know, we are going to support both iOS and Android.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to work on iPhone, iPad, Android tablets, and the Android phone. And that was what made it so popular, was that it was relatively inexpensive compared to things like the $250, Samsung Galaxy Gear. Now, this is now, you know, almost half of that price, depending on what store you go to. So it ends up being, you know, the least expensive, and really, now that there's such a huge community behind it, the most featureful.
So Pebble, the company, has grown then?
Yes, they've grown significantly. They have a lot of attention right now, and they've been continually working with developers to give them new tools to make the watch more useful. And this, you know, this move to the Pebble Steel really addressed my only real complaint about the watch, which was, you know, the one that I have is bright red with a black band that has a red stripe on it. If I go to, you know, an important meeting or you know, even to parent-teacher conference, I'm not likely to wear this thing on my wrist just because it looks kind of childish. And this, the Steel version of the smartwatch that was just announced and will be available soon, really addresses that. It looks much, much nicer.
Do you have to charge the watch very often? How is it powered?
I end up having to charge the watch about once a week. And one of the things they did when they designed the watch, no, it's not bad at all. One of the things they did that was really cool when they designed the watch is it has a USB cable, but instead of having to plug it into the watch, like having to shove the port into the watch like you would with your phone, it actually has a magnetic clip. So it just kind of magnetizes to the side of the watch, and you set it down, it charges overnight, and when you unplug it, you're good for another week.
Sheesh. And what did you say this, what's the Steel watch cost, the Pebble Steel?
The Steel watch is going to be $249. It's stainless steel. It comes in stainless steel or this kind of matte black as the result of some kind of oxidizing coating. But they will both be available. They come with a leather band or as well as a matching color band in stainless steel, whichever color you get.
How big is it?
A little more expensive. So the regular Pebble straps across my wrist. It's about 2.5 inches.
Okay.
And this is substantially smaller. I actually have a couple of pictures of them side by side. It's smaller and narrower. They intentionally made it kind of thinner so that it would, fit nicer with, kind of the professional look.
Okay. Well, it's just nice to have an independent company out there doing something like that.
Yeah, as a third party, this is cool. I would really be surprised if they responded to Google or Apple saying, hey, we'd like to buy you, just because they have so much attention right now.
All right. Steam Machine. We have talked about the company Valve and their gaming system called Steam on the show before, but remind us what it's about and what is happening at CES.
So Valve made a whole bunch of noise a couple of months ago when they decided that they were going to try and put a game console that was really more like a PC in the living room. Mm-hmm. They wanted to create an operating system for computers that you could put in the living room and it felt like a game console. And Steam already has hundreds and hundreds of games in their library to play from. So it created this really interesting kind of all digital experience that you'd be able to play in the living room. And instead of releasing their own console as kind of one box that would compete against the Xbox or the PlayStation 4, they opened up their doors to 13 different companies who each released their own machine at CES last year, or this year, excuse me, in order to, really cover a wide range of uses. So if you want like the really, really high-end gaming machine where it has the absolute best of everything, then there's a company who's making that device. Whereas if you want something that is priced similarly to the Xbox One or the PlayStation 4, then there's a company that's designing that as well, and pretty much everything in between. So you have to imagine a game console made by 13 different companies where the prices start at $499 and go up as high as $6,000.
Right. Where are the economies of scale for something like that when you're splitting it up between so many different developers?
Well, so the operating system is going to remain the same on each one of these things. This is purely a hardware inspection at this point. Everything that's going – the idea is that the inside of these would all run the same. When you turn them on, the interface would all look the same. The only thing that would be different is the quality of visual response when you actually start to play a game. And so in that they have – if you have a brand new 4K TV – then you would obviously want one of the higher quality gaming systems, where if you have, just a regular high definition television, then you're used to the Xbox or the PlayStation, you really just want something that is like that, but also plays your Steam games, then, there's a console in that price range as well.
All right. So can the market sustain so many different choices?
Do you think absolutely
winners...
not.
Okay. All right. So winners and losers will emerge. Any predictions?
I definitely think that the lower cost consoles are going to be the first ones to grab a lot of attention. They are made by a company with kind of an odd name. It is iBuyPower, which is a really popular name in kind of the PC market, but not a very friendly name when you compare it to things like Xbox and PlayStation, as far as how it would sit in the living room. But Alienware is going to be making one as well. They haven't announced pricing yet, and Alienware has a really powerful brand name behind it. It's something that a lot of PC gamers are big fans of, so I can see that being kind of popular. But a lot of these more expensive ones, the ones that are, there are a lot of them in the $1,200 and $1,400 range. I don't see them surviving more than a couple of months.
Right. Do you think they're ever going to be a serious threat to Xbox or PlayStation?
I think that the concept as a whole is going to be a threat to the PlayStation and the Xbox, but I don't know that any of these individual consoles are going to be something that causes Microsoft and Sony concern. I think that this is a really great first step. I think it's really weird that there are so many companies eager to release what essentially is the same thing in weird kind of varying price points. But I think that, you know, as soon as they can settle on a price point and a feature set, that Microsoft and Sony will have some real competition on their hands.
All right. Russell Holley, thanks for joining us. We'll hear more from you next week, I hope, about CES.
Absolutely.
Okay. Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.